policy open this Monday, February 28, 2005. And as you know, Oregonians really want the state legislature to start dealing with the high rising costs of health care. And we have a number of issues, and one of them is hospital costs. And one way that we can deal with that is through looking at how much does hospital costs, what are they, and what can they do. We are very honored to have two people who are going to present some information on hospital rate regulation. And John Comer is a program officer for the Milbank Memorial Fund, which is a New York-based endowed national foundation that provides nonpartisan analysis, study, research, and communication on significant issues in health policy. He's actually spent 19 years in Maryland state government, where he's had various positions, including executive director of the Maryland Health Care Commission and the Health Services Cost Review Commission, the agency overseeing Maryland's all-payer hospital rate-setting system.
Better get over here, right?
He's contributing editor of the American Journal of Public Health and was recently named as a director of Care First Blue Cross Blue Shield. He also served as chair of the steering committee of the Reforming States Group, and that is a bipartisan group of executive and legislative leaders. He's been a member of the Academy of Health for many years and has served on the nominating committee, the Health Services Research Information Advisory Committee, and the Academy Fellows Committee. He has a B.S. from the Johns Hopkins University and a Master's in Public Health from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Also, we also have Robert Murray, who is actually the executive director of Maryland's Health Services Cost Review Commission, and the state commission regulates the rates that Maryland hospitals are allowed to charge. So we're very honored to have them out here. They say it's actually, they're supposed to get a foot of snow back there, but we're just starting to get some rain that we desperately need. So would John Colmers and Robert Murray please come forward? Yes, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Robert Murray. I'm the Executive Director of the Maryland Health Services Cost Review Commission.
And I'm John Colmers. I'm a Senior Program Officer with the Milbank Memorial Fund. It's our pleasure to be here today to present you and the rest of the committee with information on Maryland's experience with hospital rate setting. It should be clear at the outset that we're here not to testify on the merits of any particular bill, but to provide you with some background information on how Maryland sets rates, why it decided to do so over 30 years ago, and what the performance and characteristics of that system is. And what we'd like to do this afternoon is provide you some information to that end. Bob and I have divided our work into several parts. I get to do ancient history, and Bob will talk to you more about the current performance, the types of information that the commission collects, how they actually go about setting rates, and the various programs that they have operating the system. Hospital rate setting began in Maryland in the early 1970s, and it's important to place in context, I think, why Maryland decided to go in the direction of rate setting by understanding what the precursor was in Maryland prior to the onset of rate setting. Clearly, throughout the 1960s, with the advent of Medicare and Medicaid, and predominantly in the private insurance market as well, cost-based reimbursement was a manner in which hospitals would pay. Whatever their costs were, that is what was provided, and it provided very strong incentives for providers to spend more. Essentially, the more you spent, the more you got. There were serious problems in increasing costs for public payers, for Medicare and Medicaid. Even back then, as we, I'm sure you all still face those problems in, here in Oregon. It led to a substantial expansion in new technologies, and it largely was an open-ended system that rewarded hospitals for doing more and not for being more efficient or effective in what they were doing. You may recall also in the 1970s there were significant problems in the general economy. There were attempts to impose wage and price controls in the 1970s to hold down inflation. And the response at the national level on the hospital cost side was the advent of a prospective payment system in the 1980s. Medicare moved to their PPS system in 1983, and there they set a specific payment amount per admission, and which varies depending on the type of case that it is, depending on the diagnosis and the procedures that are performed. And that has largely constrained cost growth on the Medicare side for the hospital side without adversely affecting quality. Now, it's important to note, and I'll get into this in a little bit more detail later on, that much of what led Medicare to move to the prospective payment system was the experience of states like Maryland that had moved forward and had their own rate-setting systems. New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Maryland all had all-payer rate-setting systems, and that is what helped lead Medicare to move towards their prospective payment system. And these hospital-based rate-setting systems were really an attempt by the states to experiment and to do things differently than what was being done generally elsewhere across the country to try to control a very serious problem of expanding costs. And as a result of the Medicare waiver, the goals of these systems were to contain cost and to provide improved access and greater equity in the payment system, and at the same time provide an opportunity for the federal government and other payers to learn different approaches to setting rates and constraining costs. One of the things that that we will get into when we talk in more detail in Maryland is to talk about the availability of capital. It is a major issue for hospitals, whether or not they have sufficient capital to replace and provide new technology. We'll talk about that to some degree today. In many ways, most states have some form of prospective rate setting, at least for their Medicaid programs, by 1980. Now, I thought it was going to be important to provide some information about Maryland itself, just so that you can put some of the issues into perspective. Maryland is a state with a population of 5.5 million people. The over age 65 population is at 12%. It has the fifth highest per capita income in the country. We have 47 acute care hospitals in the state. 46 of them are community hospitals, that is to say, nonprofit institutions. And we have one that is a private hospital, a proprietary hospital. And they range in size and complexity from one of the country's premier teaching hospitals, Johns Hopkins Hospital, with over 1,000 beds, and ranked as the number one hospital for years now by U.S. News and World Report in terms of the quality in the country, and all the way down to a 30-bed rural hospital out on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay, McCready Hospital. There are, in addition to Hopkins, two other substantial teaching hospitals there, University of Maryland Hospital and Sinai Hospital. And most of the other hospitals are in the 250 to 300 bed range as non-teaching institutions. But there is a considerable variety. The industry itself is about $9 billion in hospital revenue, and there are about 700,000 admissions to the hospital each year in Maryland. So you can see the scale is maybe a third or so larger in Maryland, both in terms of population, in terms of the number of hospitals, and revenue, but not entirely out of line. And as I say, a broad range of experience. Now, why rate setting? You know, why the concept of looking to have a government agency set the rates for hospitals? And I think it's important to spend a little bit of time talking about why, what the theoretical underpinnings are behind that. Why would a state want to get into this? And I think I would venture to say there are a couple of theoretical reasons that I can talk about, and then we can talk about the practical and political reasons as well for why this moved forward. On the more theoretical side, for those who say rate setting is antithetical to competition and to the free market, and we need to have free market solutions to things, I want to stress that my academic training is as an economist. I learned about markets. I like markets. I think markets provide incredible incentives for efficiency. But I've also learned as an economist that there are certain preconditions that you need to have an effective market, to make a market work. The first of which is that price is really important. Price regulates markets. That's the thing you learn in Economics 101, that price is how markets equilibrate. Well, in healthcare, because the commodity that we are purchasing is variable, because few people get sick, but if they do get sick, they can run up very high bills, we've decided to protect ourselves from this risk, this relatively low risk but with high financial consequences, by purchasing insurance, by pooling the risk among ourselves. Well, the one thing that insurance does more than anything else is that it removes price from the equation for individuals. They are not seeing the true price of what it is that they are purchasing. So that when you look at the notion of a competitive market in healthcare and in hospital care in particular, the most important feature of a competitive market is not there, and that is the sensitivity to price. The second thing that makes healthcare different than other markets is what I would term a difference in information. Again, one of the critical components of a truly competitive market is accurate and timely information. That is how buyers and sellers know how to establish the price in a competitive fashion. Well, in healthcare, you don't have that information, in part because it's very complicated. You rely on other people to make decisions, which is a good thing. I didn't go to medical school. Although I went to Hopkins, I didn't go to the medical school. I have to rely on other people to make decisions for me in healthcare. And because of that lack of information, others make decisions in healthcare for us, whether it is a physician, a nurse, another healthcare provider, or an insurance plan will help decide to make decisions on our behalf. And because of that, other people making decisions, it makes a very different arrangement than what you have in a normally competitive market. So on a theoretical grounds, part of what drove Maryland was a recognition that the market for hospital services is imperfect, and that the idea and the structure of rate setting in Maryland is largely to replicate some of the features that you would have in a competitive market, and to allow the institutions then to compete with one another under these common set of ground rules. And it's largely what folks have called a public utility model of regulation, in part because, as it was the case for many public utilities, which were natural monopolies, like most hospitals are, natural monopolies, or at least oligopolies, and maybe only one hospital in a market, or in some instances a few hospitals. They're relatively few, so you don't have easy market entry and exit. Maryland decided to establish this public utility model of rate regulation. And there, the legislative goals were fourfold. One is to contain costs, to hold hospital costs to rates of increase that were more sustainable. At the time that rate setting began, and I'll show this slide in a moment, Maryland was at 25% above the national average in cost per admission and increasing at rates each and every year faster than the rest of the country. So we were above the national average and moving further away from it each and every year. The second goal was to improve access to care. As we all know, and it's true in the case in Oregon, there are a substantial number of people who have no health insurance whatsoever. And while containing costs can help make insurance more affordable, generally, part of the goal here was to address the problem of uncompensated care. Hospitals in Maryland were facing serious problems of not being able to be paid and receive coverage for their patients, and having to try to extract payments from either those individuals or by cost shifting that to other payers, and it became problematic. There was a desire to make the system more equitable, and by that I mean more fair. There's certain inherent unfairness in the system that was in place previously. And fourth, to provide a degree of financial stability and predictability for hospitals, to make the system more reliable and so that the hospital could operate in a way that was more predictable without the type of fluctuations that they had been facing. So what the law essentially did in Maryland was to create a 7-member commission, much like a public service commission, of members appointed by the governor to serve 4-year staggered terms. These were part-time commissioners with a full-time staff. The decisions of the commission were politically and legally independent of other departments, so that the commission could render its decision without the influence of the Medicaid program, the health department, the legislature directing specific provisions of how the rates were set. It was done in a technical manner, like a public service commission. Decisions of the commission were appealable to the courts, so there were cases that went to the Court of Appeals in Maryland, our highest court in Maryland, that determined the jurisdiction and the authority of the commission. So it was not that it did not have any oversight, but it was not an administrative arm, and that was important. It was important for the hospitals to know that it wasn't the Medicaid program or other arms of state government trying to run the decisions. The statutory language.
Mr. Comer, who makes up now the 7-member commission?
I'll let Bob talk about
that. That'll be later.
Bob, you can answer that now.
It's usually very representative of the major players within the healthcare market and the hospital market. We have a chairman who is a former CFO of Johns Hopkins Hospital. Vice chair is a physician who is a rear admiral in the U.S. Health Service. We have a labor leader, a hospital president who is on the commission, a physician, as well as a health economist. So you have that broad array. Usually also we'll have someone from the insurance industry. Background.
Mr. Cruz? Yeah. Senator Cruz?
Do they serve at the pleasure of the governor?
Yes, they serve 4-year standard terms. They're appointed by the governor, and that is correct, yes.
The governor can remove someone for improprieties. The governor does not have the... they don't serve at the pleasure in the sense that when they have a change in administration, there's automatically a change. The governor may select who the chairman is, however, and that does change when you get a new governor who would appoint in each year. But members themselves stay the same.
So the reason for the question and not the pleasure of which would mean, at least in our context, that the governor could remove somebody without cause. And just reappoint, but you're saying that he can only remove with cause?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And I don't think that has ever happened in the where the governor's ever removed someone.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Did I hear you say a consumer advocate?
There's a labor leader that we've had on the commission in the past. I don't know if there's been a specific consumer member.
There have been consumer members over the years. Again, it varies over time. They're 4-year staggered terms. It takes an awful lot of time for commissioners to do this, even on a part-time basis. But we have been fortunate over the years in having governors appoint very qualified, dedicated people.
I guess that bothers me a little bit because there should be a position called consumer advocate, not labor, not whatever, but then that's way you guys run your business?
Well, I guess and one of the things that I think is a success factor of the commission is that, and I've heard this mentioned about the commission too, when you come in and you, if you were to close your eyes and hear the commissioner speak, there's generally not that tendency to represent one constituency on the commission. Instead, what we find, though, is they do bring their expertise from different areas to bear on decision-making, and you get a balanced decision-making process as a result.
And I would say one of the reasons that they have this broader perspective is that there's a relatively small number of commissioners. So you don't have 15 members, and so that there would be then a tendency to have a particular member represent a particular interest. Because you have only 7 members, they have to really represent a broad set of interests. And as a practical matter, it has meant then that you don't have an us versus them mentality build up among the commissioners. And the model, and we'll describe it in greater detail later, is one in which really the commission sort of sits in the middle of the arguments that the hospital have for asking for rate increases, the payers coming before this public forum, the Blue Crosses and the other insurers, and the professional staff that sits in the middle to represent the interests of the public at large. And then it's the commission's decision then to render on rates. So that has not really been a serious issue in Maryland, but obviously...
I think it would be here.
If we can go on to the next slide... we have been in operation for 31 years. Now, 31 and 71 is 2002.
Setting rates in 74.
Yeah. So we started setting rates in 1974. One of the features of the legislation was when the law passed, they provided a period of time for the commission to essentially get itself up and running. And that allowed the commission to set up a uniform reporting system and to... retain a professional staff and do the background work to get going. Maryland is the last state to retain an all-payer hospital rate setting system. We'll talk a little bit about why and what happened in these other states. I would say it is a combination of factors why New York, Massachusetts, and New Jersey, the three other states with all-payer rate setting, gave it up. In part, I would say it is the nature of the systems. Those three other systems were quite different than Maryland's and how they were designed and developed. And Bob will talk about this in more detail. But to a large extent, our system, I think, is more was designed more to encourage payers and hospitals both simultaneously to become more efficient and effective, number one. And number two, I think that, and we'll see this in another slide or two, the Hospital Association in Maryland has largely been very supportive of the rate setting system over the years, and they did not want to see the system disappear. Now, that may cause one to worry that there has been capture theory. That's an economic theory where the regulatees capture the work of the regulators and get them to do their bidding. I don't think that has been the case in Maryland, and I'll talk in a few minutes about why I think that not to be the case. The commission itself is relatively small. In addition to only having 7 members, there are only a full-time staff of 25 people. This is to regulate, again, an industry that is $6.6 billion in size.
Nine overall.
The operating budget of the commission is $3.5 million, so a tick under $3.5 million. Another important feature of the Maryland system is that the methodologies are largely formula driven. They are not written into the statute. And then there is therefore no need for a large staff to do detailed annual cost audits. The commission itself meets on a monthly basis. Virtually all of the activities of the commission are done in public. We have a very strong sunshine law in Maryland that requires everything except largely personnel matters or matters related to litigation to be done in an open setting. Now, rate setting in Maryland, as I said, has been supported by the Hospital Association and by most of the hospitals in Maryland over the years. One of the reasons that I think that has led the Hospital Association, and indeed, when you look at the history of the rate-setting law, it was largely the hospitals that helped led to its enactment. I think it was driven by the fact that the Maryland Hospital Association may be unique in the country in that it is hospital trustees that run the Hospital Association, not hospital administrators. It is hospital trustees who form the trustees of the Maryland Hospital Association, not hospital administrators. And these business and community leaders tend to have a somewhat different perspective on rising hospital costs. In their day jobs, they see the effect of rising hospital costs in the form of higher health insurance costs, their inability perhaps to provide health insurance as generous, or if at all, otherwise. Now, they certainly do continue to have an interest in the success and the performance of their institution. They have that pride in that. But they have a little bit different view of things, and I think that has colored the view of the hospitals in Maryland over the years. Bob and I also have had the experience over the years, I will say, of watching new hospital administrators come to the state after having worked in a hospital somewhere else in where there is no rate setting, and they are the ones who come in and say, why do we have this rate setting system? If I could only be allowed to compete the way that I did in the state that I came from, we would be much better off. And Bob and I used to have a little side bet for how long it would take that administrator to come back to us, and they all did, how long it would take for them to come back to us and say, you know, as much as I disliked the system when I came here, it makes a great deal of sense for my institution. And these are the types of people who become the strongest supporters. It typically takes about 2 years is what we have found, and have been very strong supporters of it. But having industry support has been very important. It has also been strongly supported by the political establishment over the years. The House, the Senate, the governor, I said, has made very strong appointments to the commission. And most importantly, and this may be something you may not want to hear, is that the legislature has largely stayed out of rate setting. And hospitals have not gone to the legislature and complained about the rate setting system as a way to get them to do something. It has largely been apolitical, and that has been very, very important. I can think of only one instance in the years that I was at the Rate Setting Commission where I had a state representative call me up and complain about what the commission was doing with their hospital. And when I explained to them what the hospital was trying to do, the legislator said, thank you very much, and never bothered me again. And so it has worked very well in that regard. Private industry has supported it. The insurance industry, again, dominated largely by a regional Blue Cross plan, and business and labor have largely been supportive of the system. Now, why each of these groups? What were the political dynamic that held them together? Well, the state legislature clearly wanted to find a way to control hospital costs, to say we were above the national average and moving further away from it. They wanted to figure out a way to keep hospitals financially sound so that they would not be coming to the legislature looking for additional relief. And they were also concerned about making sure that their constituents had access to care, even those who did not have health insurance. And again, sort of this dual process: by holding down hospital costs, you make insurance more affordable. And then even in those instances where people don't have health insurance, have a mechanism to pay for hospital and compensated care. Now, the hospitals in Maryland were worried about what the federal health care reform was going to do. They liked the idea of having a system that was locally controlled, that had Marylanders designing the system. And even though we are loath to admit it that CMS is actually located in Maryland, we like the idea, or the Marylanders like the idea, that it is local folks who are doing it and not folks at CMS or in Washington or in insurance carriers elsewhere around the country that are determining it, but Marylanders. And they also were concerned about financial stability. And in this regard, they were willing to make the trade-off between having a system that would constrain their rate of growth, but at the same time provide them this financial stability and this mechanism to pay for uncompensated care. That's, in a nutshell, was the deal that was worked out. They liked that idea. Trade off some of the additional profits that they could have made for a system that in the long run was going to be more sustainable and supportive.
Senator Morissette.
We had a meeting the other night at which time people came to us, during which time people came to us and talked about bankruptcy, liens against their property, exorbitant bills, and so on. Now, you mentioned under state legislature, improve access to care, people without health insurance had a way to pay off their medical costs and so on. So,
well, I'll talk about it in more detail, but very, very simply what it means is in the rates that the commission sets for every hospital in the state, there is a provision for uncompensated care. There's about $550 million each year, $500 million each year, that the hospitals are allowed to charge, that the payers pay, that the hospitals have available to them to provide uncompensated care for people who do not have health insurance. So is it better to have people have health insurance? Absolutely. I would much rather see a situation where people have health insurance. But here we have a second best solution, where if they do not have health insurance, hospitals have a mechanism to pay for it, and patients get the service. We have not had lawsuits in Maryland against hospitals by people who don't have health insurance for trying to get care and coverage. It is built into the system. It's one of the cornerstones of how we operate.
And different hospitals, is that correct, that different hospitals' rates are different, as well as their the amount of money that they, or how they treat their uninsured is different? So
absolutely.
It's hospital by hospital, and so this commission works with each hospital on their...
And Bob will describe shortly a little bit more about the rate-setting system itself, but you're absolutely correct, Madam Chair. The commission, when it sets rates that are different for each hospital. The manner of setting rates is the same. The rules that you use for setting up the rates are the same. So it's a common application. But the results are different. So the rates that you have at a Johns Hopkins hospital are going to be different than what you have at the University of Maryland, different than what you have at a suburban hospital, and so forth. Similarly, the provision in rates for uncompensated care differs from one hospital to the other, driven largely by characteristics of the patient population that they serve. If they are in an area where they are likely to get more patients who have no insurance, they are going to have a much higher provision in their rates for uncompensated care than others. And Bob can be, we'll be able to talk about that. Finally, on the last point on this slide is that health insurance companies were also supportive of this as a way of addressing the cost-shifting problem, both from the public payers as well as from other private payers as well. And cost-shifting, as you well know, is the phenomenon in which a hospital, when they get underpaid or perceive that they are being underpaid by one party, attempts to get that by raising their rates to somebody else, where somebody else gets it in the neck. And we'll talk in a moment about how that does not occur in Maryland. Now, the statutory authority in the Maryland law is relatively simple. The commission has to certify that the rates of the hospital are reasonable, that there is a reasonable relationship between the rates and the underlying costs of the hospital, and that the rates are set equitably without undue preference or discrimination. That's it. That's largely the statutory authority in those three lines. And so what the legislature did was give the commission itself very broad authority to actually figure out how to do it. These are almost constitutional provisions that we were operating under and had to devise systems to make sure that the rates were reasonable, that there was this reasonable relationship between costs and what the charges were, and that they were set equitably. not equally, but equitably without undue discrimination. And the law also requires substantial public accountability through access to the information about hospitals and their performance. Now, the Commission's authority to regulate hospitals is limited in the law as well. It is limited to inpatient hospital services as defined by Medicare. We use Medicare law to define what inpatient means. We regulate outpatient services if they are provided at the hospital. We cover emergency services and virtually no regulatory authority over physician services. So this is not physicians, this is the hospital piece. It's largely inpatient and outpatient and emergency room services. And as I say, there are 47 acute care hospitals.
Senator Cruz?
Okay, so you're regulating what the hospitals charge, but not what the physicians charge for services in the hospital.
That is correct.
Okay, and one more question.
Yes.
You have outpatient services. Do you have a lot of ambulatory surgery centers? Are they in this or outside of it?
It depends on where they are. If they are at the hospital, they are regulated. If they're freestanding, they're literally at the hospital.
Okay.
If they are freestanding and they are owned by a hospital, we do not regulate them. And on the physician regulatory side, the Commission for a number of years tried to exercise its authority over hospital-based physicians, radiologists, pathologists, anesthesiologists, those physicians who are associated with a single hospital. I can't go to a hospital and bring my radiologist with me. I have to use the radiologist who is at the facility, same with the anesthesiologist and so forth. The Commission tried to exercise jurisdiction over them. We thought the law gave us the authority to do that. We went to the Court of Appeals, which is our Supreme Court, on a couple of occasions, and we lost, frankly. And so that they are not regulated by us.
Because clearly physician costs are a component in this, so how does that stay in check if it's not part of this regulatory system?
On the hospital side, to a very large extent, hospitals themselves are a very significant component of healthcare costs.
Right.
I'm not sure where they are, what percentage it is in Oregon, but here in Maryland, when you add the inpatient, the outpatient, and the emergency, it's roughly 40% of total healthcare costs. So it is a substantial piece. On the physician side, I think part of the argument is that, as I said before, in most jurisdictions, hospitals are monopolies or oligopolies, and not many of them. In most communities, there are quite a few physicians, and so there is more likelihood of a competitive market for physician services than there is for hospital services. Now, our argument was when we went to the Court of Appeals was that is not the case for these hospital-based docs because that you don't have a choice when you go there. But you know the law was not on our side, and the Court of Appeals ruled against us, and so that was out. Has it meant that the system has been a failure because you're squeezing the balloon, as some people have said, on this side, and the balloon explodes over here? I think not, and I think most of the credible studies that have done have looked at rate setting in Maryland have shown that it has been a success, notwithstanding the fact that it does not cover physician services.
Thank you.
So, again, the Commission responsibilities, the responsibilities that the Commission has is relatively straightforward. Hospitals have to charge rates that the Commission sets. That includes governmental payers, Medicare and Medicaid, through something that's called the Medicare waiver, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail later. And by law, insurance companies have to pay Commission-approved rates. So it is on both sides. Hospitals have to charge it. Insurance companies, including HMOs, have to pay it. There is no discounting in Maryland other than discounting that is permitted by the Commission that is demonstrated to be cost-justified. You cannot get a discount because you're big. Just because you're the biggest doesn't mean that you get a discount. If you can demonstrate that you're actually saving the system money, then you are permitted discounts. And so, for example, there are discounts permitted for prompt payment. If an insurance company provides what amounts to working capital to the hospital, they have earned a discount, and they get that. But just because you're big, you can't go in and negotiate a lower discount. And the effect of that, we'll see in a moment, really addresses this cost-shifting problem dramatically in Maryland in comparison to other jurisdictions. Hospitals also are required to report detailed information in the manner in which and the format that the commission requires. So this is a system that is inundated with information, which is largely in the public domain. It provides one of the features of the competitive market that I talked about earlier, which is a lot of information on the types of costs that a hospital has, where those costs are coming from, and so forth. So what has been the performance of what has been the performance of Maryland over the years? Well, if you look at the cost per admission in Maryland, when we started out, as I said, we were about 25% above the national average and going up faster than that over the years. As of 2003, we're 6% below the national average. Now, I know there will be those who say, well, you know, cost per admission is one thing. What about, you know, cost per capita? And part of the issue here might be, you know, you're holding down, increases in hospital costs when somebody goes into the hospital, but aren't you having much higher per capita costs nevertheless? And I think part of the answer to that is yes, we do have higher per capita costs in Maryland than you do, say, on the West Coast. Part of that is a practice pattern phenomenon, that is, East Coast versus West Coast. And we all know that there's very broad variation in how healthcare is delivered from one part of the country to another. Secondly, I would say that part of it is also driven by the fact that in Maryland, we have pretty porous borders. And while it had been the case in the early 70s that a lot of patients from Maryland who lived in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., used to go into hospitals in Washington for healthcare services. In the late 70s and early 80s, there were a number of new hospitals that were built in the Maryland suburbs, in Montgomery and Prince George's County, just outside of Washington, D.C. And patients that previously had gone into the district were now staying in Maryland. So that has an effect on the per capita costs as well. So I think part of it is legitimate, part of it's not. The fact remains, though, that once somebody is in the hospital in Maryland, it is less costly to treat them than it is elsewhere. And so if the practice patterns here are such that the patients are treated more on an outpatient basis already here, there might be a way of constraining the rate of increase in cost per admission and still accrue a benefit here as well. It's not that it has been a failure in Maryland by any stretch of the imagination. I think we have better access to care than any other state in the country. We have no public governmental hospitals in operation in Maryland. We have no hospital of last resort. We have no charity care hospital where patients go. As I said before, over $500 million of uncompensated or unpaid care is financed through the rate-setting system. There is no patient dumping in Maryland. The system is also the most equitable system in the country. By that I mean that it is fair to all of the payers. And we'll see that in a chart in a moment, that the degree of cost shifting is eliminated in Maryland, so it makes it fairer for everybody. It has provided a system that is financially stable for hospitals, and again, provided public accountability and transparency of costs and charges. And one of the things about this last point is that the largest user of this information, of the case mix data, the cost information, are the other hospitals. They are the biggest users of that information, and the culture has been created where everybody gets to look at everybody else's data. That is not a bad thing, and is operated, I think, to the benefit of the institutions in Maryland. Here is the cost per admission figures in Maryland. You can see we started out above 25% above the national average, declining over the years. reaching a low point in 1992, while I'll point out that I was still the executive director at that point, where we were at 13% below the national average. There was a period of time where we crept up relative to the rest of the country and went above the national average. But again, in the last 4 or 5 years, we have trended below the national average again, and as I say, we're now at 6% below the national average.
Just a comment on that. My daughter is taking trigonometry, pointed out to me that this has nothing to do with executive directors. This is really a cosine wave that we have here. So.
That's right.
And part of this, I think, is another important feature about the timeline here. And Bob, again, we'll talk about it again. This system has not been the same system from 1976 to 2003. One of the great beauties of the waiver, and one of the great beauties of the way the legislature wrote the law, was that the commission could change the system over time to address whatever the new problem of the day was. And part of what happened at this tail end here was the fact that the system needed to be redesigned. There were new dynamics and new characteristics that were in place that had to be addressed, and that was what happened during that time period, and the system changed in a quarter. This is the information on hospital uncompensated care. If you look at the bars, that is the dollar amount that's measured on the left-hand side, and as I said, it's a little over $500 million in uncompensated care is provided in rates, and that amounts to about 7.3% of revenue. Hospitals are allowed to charge that, and they use that then, and all payers contribute to it, to pay for the services of patients who do not have health insurance.
Can you explain that a little bit again?
When the commission sets the rates for hospitals, or what they are permitted to charge for all of their services, built into that rate is a markup, an additional provision in their rates that on average amounts to 7.3%. Now, in some cases, it's higher than that for a hospital. In some cases, it's lower. But when a hospital then charges, because they're required by law to charge those rates, and payers pay it, that means that the hospital is able to collect that money and use it to pay for the cost, the hospital cost, of patients who do not have health insurance.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Morrison.
I guess what I was getting at when I asked the last question about people being sued and having liens against their houses, this would not preclude that necessarily, because there are some people, I would imagine, who will eventually pay their bill but just need the time to do it. Now, that's what I'm getting at. Do you make allowances for that?
The commission created the system to provide incentives for hospitals to go after and to collect payment when payment was available.
Yeah.
But it also at the same time meant that they did not have to collect from people who did not have the money. And so there are incentives for the hospitals to have a good credit and collection policy, not to write everything off. It's not simply passed through. There's the amount that the hospital is permitted is based on not what their performance is, but characteristics of the patients in the area.
Well, that's still, excuse me.
Yes.
Maybe the kind of question I'm asking is you're not able to answer. I mean, there are, if a person has the ability to pay,
yes,
but needs to pay it over a 4 to 5 or 6.
Oh, there's nothing to preclude them from doing that.
But there's nothing to preclude them from doing a lien also, right?
No.
Okay. But I guess what I'm hoping and thinking is that your system makes it easier for people to take responsibility for paying their bills without having a lien on their house to do it. Of course, that probably happens in our system too. But
well, I mean, there is no doubt in the country as a whole that more people enter bankruptcy because of health care related issues than any other reason. I think the point that the system has been structured here is that hospitals have a mechanism to pay for this care if need be. They also have strong incentives to continue to collect from people who can pay.
Yeah.
In Oregon, I think the number was, correct me if someone else has that figure, 50%, close to 50% of bankruptcies in the state of Oregon are due to medical costs.
Right.
And I was just, is that what you were getting at? Was it,
yeah.
Is it the same in Maryland?
I'm not sure what the state specific number is in Maryland, but it is very high, and I know nationally it's the number one reason for people filing back.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now, the next set of slides are going to talk about this question of markup and the equity that is built into the system. Maryland has the lowest markup of hospital rates to cost in the country. That's the difference between what the hospital's actual underlying costs are and how much they charge on average for their services. Now, elsewhere around the country, what happens is that Medicare, under the federal government, Medicaid, the state government, they pay, you know, in some instances, quite a bit less than what costs are. On average, I would say Medicare probably is close to what costs are. In some instances, some specific institutions below, and some institutions above. In most cases, Medicaid pays less. As I said before, there are third-party payers who negotiate discounts. Hospitals have to be able to recover the cost of uncompensated care in other jurisdictions. It's not like they throw them out on the streets here. They do provide uncompensated care, but they have to do that by raising their rates as well. On average, the average markup between what the costs are and what the charges are in the U.S. is 150%. Okay, that's more than double. They have to more than double their costs to set their charges, knowing that they're going to get less than that. Looking at a hospital charge master is worse than looking at the sticker price on a car. You look at a sticker price on a car, and if you've paid that sticker price, you know, you walk away pretty sad. You know, it's all negotiating under it. In the case of hospitals, charges are relatively meaningless. They're set very high, and it's, you know, how lucky can you be to get it lower? On average, the markup in Oregon is 82%, and in Maryland, it's the lowest in the country. And this is according to AHA statistics. It's at 25%. I actually think the real markup is closer to 15%. I think these data are wrong, at least if they are related to Maryland. I don't think it's as high as 25%. And I'll show you graphically on the next slide what this means. On the left-hand side, we have this line across the middle, which is what the hospital's actual costs are. Now, the big black line is what they charge. Okay, the published charge at the top is $1,000 a day. So small private insurance may get a modest discount off the charges, 5 or 10%. Medicare and Medicaid may be paying well less than costs. A large HMO may be able to negotiate a 50, 60% discount off the charges. Well, guess what? They're still paying well above costs. And it is a very uneven and unequal system. It is, like I said, looking at the sticker price on a car. Now, in Maryland, the system is such that at any one hospital, all payers are going to be paying the same set of rates. The rates are marked up. In this case, we still show it at 25%, which is what the AHA, American Hospital Association's statistics show. Everybody pays the same rate, and they all pay that same markup. It is a far more equitable system. Now, does this mean that every payer pays exactly the same for each hospital service? And the answer to that is no. Because the way the rate-setting system is structured, it means that Medicare, which is the program for the elderly, they will have much higher charges because it takes into account the longer length of stay, the more services that are required for those patients, and so forth. What this is demonstrating here is that for the unit rates, the cost per day, the cost for the lab test, the cost for the radiology exam, are all set on the same basis. If you use more of those services, that payer will end up paying more. So I don't want you to walk away from here thinking that Medicare and Medicaid and commercial insurers all pay exactly the same amount for the care that they are rendered at the hospital. But in terms of the charges or the services that they receive, all of those charges are the same. Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Cruz.
The one thing that graph doesn't show is the percent of the business that's uncompensated care, Medicare. I mean, do you get into that at some point here?
Well, as I say, on here, Medicare is the third bar over. And on this chart, I show that they are paying under cost.
Right, I understand that, but you know, when you look at your chart on the right, I mean, a factor that plays into this is what percent of the book of business is in each category.
Oh, okay. And I can do it off the top of my head. Bob will probably remember it more detailed than I do. Total charges, I think, for Medicare are roughly 35 to 40%.
Medicare is about 45%.
Medicaid is 45.
Yeah, Medicare is about 45%. Medicaid is about 13% in Maryland. Uncompensated care is about 7 to 8%, and then the balance is commercial HMO private insurance.
Fair. Thank you.
That's in terms of revenue.
One other question that often comes up is: are the hospitals in Maryland profitable? And this chart shows both regulated and unregulated activities for the hospitals. And it shows that since its inception, the hospitals on average have earned, you know, generally between 2 and 4% of revenue as a positive bottom line. I think the important feature of this slide is that is that in this system, profits are not a dirty word. Profits are something that you earn for good performance. Hospitals are allowed to earn profits. They are profitable in Maryland. They have had lower profits perhaps than other hospitals around the country on average, but I would venture to say to you, hospitals have had very good access to the capital markets in Maryland. They have not been capitally starved for capital. As I say, we have the number one hospital in the country in Maryland. They are have access to buy new technology and new services. One of the things that we have seen over the years as part of our responsibility at the Commission has been to make sure that hospitals have access to the capital markets. And it is important for them to do so, but to do so in a way that they earn the profit by being more efficient. That's how you earn profits, by being more efficient. And again, that's what you would have in a functioning market. That is how functioning markets work.
Madam Chair,
Senator Cruz.
What would be under the category of unregulated activities? Would that be foundations and things like that, or
parking lots, joint ventures with physicians, things that are outside the operations of the as I say, the regulated portions are inpatient hospital services, outpatient services provided at the hospital, and emergency services.
So I would assume a place like Johns Hopkins would have huge foundations associated with them for capital needs and things like that, and research. And
well, there's the medical school. That, like most academic medical centers, you have the medical school separate from the hospital.
Okay.
And Hopkins. When we're looking at the profitability here, I can show you what both the regulated and non-regulated profits are for Hopkins since 1971. I mean, that's publicly available. I don't have it with me here. They have fared quite well under this system.
Okay, I guess, Madam Chair, it's just the point, you know, the hospital foundations do a lot of charitable work, and they're also good fundraisers, and I was just wondering if that sort of activity was in that mix or not.
Well, again, as I said, this is both regulated and unregulated in aggregate for the whole system.
Okay.
I can provide you that information for just the regulated. We can redo the chart to just show regulated.
Would it be a big difference from what we're seeing there?
Not terribly. I mean, the lines would be the same. It'll be a little bit lower, obviously, because it includes would remove the unregulated. I will tell you, though, that in some instances, some of the unregulated services over the years for hospitals have been money losers. And in fact, for a couple of hospitals, it got them into serious trouble. Some hospitals in Maryland went out and bought physician practices. This was back in the era when they thought that was the direction that managed care was going in, that they needed to have a system where they had their primary care physicians
closely tied to their institution, and they would buy physician practices. Well, that model turned out, and then it wasn't just in Maryland that hospitals were doing it, they were doing it all over the country. It turned out to be an untenable model, and that ended up costing hospitals money. They lost money. Some of the hospitals tried to come back to the Rate Setting Commission and say, hey, we need to make up for this loss that we made on this decision, and largely the commission, I think, just largely, completely, the commission said no. You know, this is not a regulated service. We're not going to make up for the fact that you made a bad business decision.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morset.
Yeah. You have examples of hospitals who were lucky enough or smart enough to buy about 70 acres and develop the hospital on about a third of that and buy all kinds, own all the land around it that they could lease out to McDonald's and other places. So
that sounds like a redheaded Eskimo question.
It is a redheaded But those are unregulated activities, right? They own all the land around the hospital, and they control all of the businesses that go into that land, and they make lots of money on other things, right?
I would say that's not... I can't think of an instance where that has occurred in Maryland.
Oh,
yeah. But there are instances where they do have commercial properties, you know, do have property where they have it, but not to the extent that you're suggesting in the example that you gave.
Building Disneyland next to the hospital.
Thank you.
Okay, now we've talked about or alluded to the rate setting system for the Medicare waiver. It is an important component of the system. It is in part what has kept the system whole over the years. It was first granted in July 1st of 1977. Medicare waives their payment rules in Maryland, which at the time in 1977 meant it waived cost-based reimbursement. What it means since 1983 is that they've waived the prospective payment system, or PPS, payment in Maryland, in lieu of paying rates that are set by the commission. The commission continues this not by the grace of God, but by meeting a performance test. That performance test is included in Section 1814B of the Social Security Act. It has two components to that: a rate of increase test, which means that we compare how quickly hospital costs have grown in Maryland for Medicare patients since October 1, 1983, which was the start of Medicare PPS, to the most recent quarter for which data is available. This test is measured every quarter, and the commission compares itself, and we get to keep the waiver as long as we hold the rate of increase lower than what it was nationally. The other component of the system, the other portion of the waiver test, is that the system has to demonstrate that it is still all payer, that they're not special deals worked out for other payers. Everybody's paying on the same basis. Now, there is general authority available under a different section of federal law, 1886C, for other states. 1814B is only available to states that have been in continuous operation since July 1, 1977. That's that redheaded Eskimo we were talking about before, but in this case in federal law for Maryland. 1886C, however, is available for any other state to apply for. And I think the feature about the waiver that has been so important for us has been that it has allowed Maryland to experiment and to do something differently. It has allowed the system to operate over the years, grow over the years, provide adequate and stable payment over the years, and still demonstrate that it saved money to the federal government. It is, I think, been something that has been enormously valuable by having had this waiver. And I would venture to say that in Oregon, you're well familiar with waivers. I mean, the Oregon Health Plan is a good example of that, where you all decided collectively that you wanted to try to do something differently. And really, states, because of this waiver authority, are allowed to do things differently and to learn and do things differently. Medicare, back when we started, was paying on cost-based reimbursement. Because of the work that we've done in Maryland, they were able to, and these other states, they were able to develop the prospective payment system. We're continuing to change the system in Maryland. They're working on things like adding pay-for-performance measures, working on ways to improve the productivity of measuring case mix in Maryland. That's all the types of things that we can provide to the federal government in return to help them devise and change the Medicare program nationally. So it is a good thing to have these laboratories of federalism, as states are, to try to do things differently.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, it's my understanding that West Virginia has been trying to get a Maryland-style waiver for 20 years. Do you have a sense as to why they failed at it?
I don't know the specifics about West Virginia. I would imagine that part of what has to happen here is, I'm not saying that it is a simple matter to do under 1886, because it is an absolute payment. What that means is that you have to demonstrate that there's no additional money at all going into the state than if you did not have the waiver. So it's largely a redistributional issue. How do you redistribute Medicare money among hospitals in the state? That is not a simple matter, particularly if you have the hospitals who may not be interested in cooperating or giving up anything. And so I'm perfectly willing to understand that it is a difficult political battle to go forward with. I would imagine, though, that it is the type of thing, particularly given the interest in the federal government to having state experimentation, that this might be an area that would be possible. But I don't know in West Virginia what has held it up, whether there's been problems within the state, CMS saying no. They cannot get an 1814B waiver. No other state can. They could apply for an 1886C waiver. I don't know why they have not been able to be successful there.
Okay, I guess, I mean, without a waiver, it'd be hard to make the system work. So,
well, that's an interesting question to talk about. Clearly, in our opinion, the waiver is what has kept this system together. It has made it worthwhile. It has made it much more equitable. Could you conceive of a system that could operate that would work without a waiver? I suppose you could conceive of one that could work, and it might be able to develop some things that are new and innovative and still provide some degree of cost containment. Would it be as effective? Well, in our opinion, I don't think so, but it could operate. And as you say, West Virginia has a rate-setting system that applies to their non-governmental payers, and you can look at their performance over the years. It may not be as effective as Maryland has been, but it does provide some degree of transparency of information, some degree of protection for private sector payers, and some provision for hospital uncompensated care. But that's a decision for you as policymakers here in Oregon, Oregon to make.
Thank you.
I'm cutting into Bob's time. I said,
okay.
When I started out, I turned to Bob and said, I'll be done in 20 minutes.
Well, there's no way.
You didn't factor on us. So.
I'm now at the wrapping up point, I think. We're getting close to the wrapping up point. This system was created to address some common health care problems that I said at the outset. To contain growth and cost, I think we've been able to demonstrate that we have. 25% above to 6% below. Improve access to care. Have this provision in rates for uncompensated care. We think it's unparalleled access to hospital services compared to elsewhere around the country. It was to deal with inequitable payment system. Well, it is a very equitable payment system. Everybody pays on the basis of the same rates. And it has been a very created stability in the marketplace. One of the other features about the waiver is, and having a rate-setting system, is that hospitals have one-stop shopping for dealing with their financial issues. They do not go to CMS in Washington. They don't go to their state Medicaid program. They don't go to the 20, 30, or 50 insurance companies that they deal with. They go to one place, and that's the rate-setting system, to address their financial needs. And they know that they can pick up the phone and talk to these regulators and have a system that works out to be fair. Maryland's a relatively small state. As I say, there are 47 hospitals. When I was at the commission, I knew every chief executive officer. I knew every chief financial officer. I knew trustees around the state. I worked in Maryland. These were people who I saw all the time. And the system worked in part because we all knew one another and we trusted one another. It worked as a very effective system because it was locally run. It is a rate system and not a cost system. And by that, this goes back to the issue of earning a profit. We don't regulate a hospital's costs. I keep saying we still. The commission does not regulate hospital costs. It regulates their rates. So the commission, when it sets the rates, gives hospitals strong incentives to be more efficient, and they earn profits, and everything that they earn, they keep. That's the reward in a competitive market for a job well done. You keep your profits. And so this has never been a system that has gone after high-profit hospitals. It has gone after hospitals whose charges or whose rates were too high. It is a very data-driven system and formula-driven system. Bob will talk about that. Locally focused. And the commission's law is quite strong and broad, and we've had very good decisions in the court that have upheld the authority of the commission to set its rates. All parties are committed to these goals. There's a high degree of collegiality. We work with one another. The regulators are accessible. And frankly, hospitals in Maryland like the system. They would be fearful of the alternative. The system has worked well for them in terms of having access. They would fear of the problem of cost shifting and loss of control and predictability. The system has worked in Maryland over the years, and it is something that that those of us who have worked on it are very proud of. Some of these key success factors are the Medicare and Medicaid waiver has been important, availability of data, clearly defined goals and targets, of accessibilities of the regulators. It's something where we do have to worry about whether or not we're seen as being captured. We have been seen as being captured. It is focused on problem solving and negotiations. It's not grandstanding. We don't fight battles. Have not fought battles in the press. We have not fought battles in the legislature. It is a macro-oriented system, not micro. The regulators, when you only have 25 people regulating the industry, you cannot and should not get into the details of how the hospitals operate themselves. That's their business. That's what they're trained to do. The system's designed at the 10,000 or 50,000 foot level to set these overall constraints and let the hospitals be free to manage themselves as they work. The system has moved to more to a formula-based system, and it has been largely predictable and stable over the years. So my 20 minutes are up.
Senator Cruz.
One more. Through this process, through this setting, I mean, one of the issues we have clearly here in Oregon is the inappropriate use of emergency rooms for non-emergent services. Does something like that play into discussion? I mean, has Maryland done things to address those sorts of issues, or is that outside of the scope of
this? Emergency services are within the authority of the commission.
Right.
So that is something that the commission is concerned with. We are also, as in other jurisdictions, have problems with what they call orange alert or red alert. We have a very effective and well-known emergency management system in Maryland with tiered hospitals and very good access to this, medevac helicopters and emergency services and so forth. There have been times when hospitals have been on flyby or drive-by because they are at capacity. The one thing that this system does that I think is very effective is that it requires the collection of information that is publicly available that allows policymakers to evaluate when there are problems like overcrowding or inefficient use of the emergency room to determine where that is happening and why it's happening. It's not simply reliant upon ad hoc data collection. That data is there. Bob will talk about a complete data set that they now collect on emergency services that allows you to look at by acuity level, by payer, by hospital, by region of the state, and to be able to slice and dice that information to find out where there is a problem and where there isn't.
So I'll try to address a little bit of that when I get in. Very briefly, what I'll try to do and try to compress my my presentation a bit, because it gets into a little bit of the details of rate setting. But I want to talk about the data that we collect, the importance of those data. Also, how we set rates, and kind of, again, from on a macro level, what are the fundamental things that you look at when you set up a rate setting system and establish rates, how you update them over time. Also, want to talk a little bit, again, about some of what our approach has been from a regulatory standpoint, some of the key success factors that John mentioned. And then lastly, talk about how the system is continuing to change, some of the more innovative things that we're able to do because we have the rate system. John had said, well, certainly our principal legislative mandate is setting rates, but a very important part of the mandate focuses on the collection of data and the public disclosure of data. So that we see as a very important operational goal that we try to achieve. And certainly if you believe in either a regulatory approach to health care issues or a competitive approach, I think most people would agree that one major requirement is the availability of timely and accurate information. And so we have put a lot of emphasis on that. It helps with transparency of data for both the patient and the sponsor, as well as for hospitals. The databases that that we collect really can be broken down into these three areas: financial data, patient level data, which we refer to as case mix data, and then a number of other databases. The financial database really reflects the underlying building blocks of information that we use initially to set rates in the state for the hospitals. The major component of that is the annual cost report, which is analogous to the Medicare cost report that hospitals nationally file. But one major distinction in Maryland, and John referred to this, is that we did not require that hospitals all adopt a uniform accounting system. What we did require is that they report the information to us in a consistent fashion. So it's uniform reporting as opposed to uniform accounting. These are all data that hospitals currently collect and look at internally. The difference would be that they would now, under a rate system or a transparent data collection system, would now report that information, and it would be available publicly. We also collect the audited annual financial statements. We, during the course of the year, collect monthly volume and revenue statistics of hospitals, and we also monitor their financial performance during the course of the year by collecting unaudited financial statements. There is a bit of a balance in rate setting. We are interested in controlling costs, controlling charges, but we are also equally interested in having a financially healthy industry, and we do monitor the financial condition of the industry during the course of the year and over time to make sure that hospitals have sufficient revenue to meet their full financial requirements. In terms of patient-level data, the second component of our databases is also equally important, I would argue. These are data, financial, demographic, and clinical data on every discharge in the state of Maryland. Some 700,000 discharges there. It gives us a wealth of data on the actual services that are performed on patients, on the level of acuity of illness of the patients, and how those patients vary from hospital to hospital. It provides us with financial information, as I said, and also demographic information that's useful both for our agency as well as some of our sister agencies and public health initiatives within the state. It's, as I said, an equally important database because while I would argue that rate setting in a macro view is relatively straightforward, we have these general principles and concepts that underlie the basis of rate setting, the actual detail of rate setting is quite complicated. And it's complicated because we go to an extraordinary level of detail to adjust for differences across hospitals, differences in patient acuity, differences in levels of uncompensated care, differences in systematic costs that we can try to account for so that when we do our comparisons, they're apples-to-apple comparisons, and to interject a degree of fairness and equity in the system that we believe is very important for hospitals. The other case mix or patient-level data we collect are information on ambulatory surgeries that are provided at the facility. As John mentioned, we regulate outpatient services at the hospital. We also, in 97, started to collect ambulatory care visit information. This would be outpatient clinics, as well as the emergency database, which we're finding is very useful to us now in examining the issue of ER overcrowding. We can see where the new patients have come from, what level of intensity there are, what types of treatments they're receiving, and perhaps help the state both design payment mechanisms as well as other mechanisms to redirect inappropriate emergency room visits to appropriate settings. So the most important aspect there is to have the data to be able to make the right decisions. There are a number of other databases we collect. We collect information as a wage and salary survey that's administered on an annual basis. It collects average compensation by category of a hospital worker. It's not specific to individuals. There's a high degree of sensitivity, obviously, with regard to compensation data, but it does give us information to be able to adjust for labor market differences across hospital in our rate setting. Again, that detail to establish a level of fair reimbursement across facilities.
Mr. Berkovian?
Thank you, Chair. Do you know how healthcare professionals' salaries within Maryland and around the surrounding areas compare? I mean, do you pay a comparable salary for nurses, doctors, hospital administrators?
Well, certainly there are variations, and I think a large part of the variation is a function of per capita income. You know, we find that the salaries for nurses and healthcare professionals are much higher in Montgomery County, for instance, than they would be in the rural part of the state. And you're going to get that type of variation from state to state as well. Those are the major drivers, I would think, irrespective of the you see nursing shortages and surpluses over time. Of course, now Maryland, as well as the rest of the country, we are facing a nursing shortage. So you see higher use of agency nurses, and that's driven up salaries over time. I'm not sure how we compare directly to the rest of the nation compensation, but because we're fifth highest in per capita income, I would imagine we're a bit higher.
I think, quickly, if you look at the Medicare labor market index that's used in the PPS system, Maryland is about at the national average. So we're neither above nor below, overpaying or underpaying. If you use that as at least a proxy for where Maryland might be. And that's not a bad way of looking at it. We're about average.
Okay. The next slide, just take a minute there to talk about the timeliness of the data. The data are accurate because the hospitals know that we use the information they submit. The information they submit is integral to their final reimbursement, so they have a very strong incentive to have these data accurate. We also audit the data. There's a very strong auditing control function within the commission. So there are two things that ensure that the data are accurate. The timeliness is also important. For just as an example, our case mix data, the data that we collect on the 700,000 admissions, it's submitted quarterly to the commission on computer tape. We receive the information 45 days after the end of the quarter. So right now we're working on processing and finalizing December year-end 2004 information. We go through an error edit check with that, send the information back to the hospitals for correction, and then it's back to us then another 15 or 20 days after that, so that within 3 months, those data are available to the commission and also publicly to use to react to changes, to do analyses, and also they affect reimbursement. And I can't emphasize how important that timeliness and accuracy of data is really in the activities that we perform. Talk just for a minute about rate setting methodologies. I'll try to boil it down into the kind of the macro concepts. As John said, we're not a cost-based system. Cost-based reimbursement was popular in the 60s and 70s, but when you think about it, it really had the wrong set of incentives. It incentivized providers to spend more year to year, not spend less. And what we tried to do is turn that system on its head, make it prospective, set out well-defined targets, and then put the emphasis on controlling cost as a means of generating profit. As John said, that is really how functional competitive markets operate, and it does provide a degree of stability and predictability for hospitals because they know what their target is. It's a very well-defined target, and if they meet that, they will generate a sufficient profit, and it provides for more certainty in financial management. Our system is a prospective system. Hospitals largely know what they're in for from a year-to-year basis. They know what their revenues will be. They do not have to then spend the time to go out and negotiate with 10, 15, 20 different payers because of this structure. That is an administrative savings. It also allows them to focus more on their operations. In terms of how we structure rates, there are really basically four components to rate setting that ask you to focus on. One is, first, what is the structure of payment? Is it a per-case type of payment system where you pay per diagnostic group? Is it a fee-for-service type of system that pays on the basis of the individual services that are provided? We refer to that as a departmental unit rate structure or some other variation of those things, per diems. The second component you need to look at in setting up a rate system is how do you set the base revenue for a given hospital or for the system. Then once you have established that base, how do you update it over time for inflation or productivity gains, volume changes, the dynamic aspect of rate setting. And then the fourth component is really how do you monitor that rates across hospitals are reasonable relative to each other. And those are the four components of rate setting that we've focused on over time. First, with regard to structure, our system is what's referred to as a departmental unit rate system. That is, we set a rate per unit of output. An example of that would be a rate per day in the medical surgical area, or a rate per day in the ICU, or a rate per minute in the operating room. It is a dollar amount per unit of output, and it equates very directly to the revenue, to the services that an individual patient would be afforded during their stay. There are some 50 revenue centers across the hospitals that we will establish a departmental unit rate for. What that system does is it provides a degree of equity at the patient and the payer level that you don't see under a per-case system like the federal PPS Medicare DRG system. It means that when you go into the hospital as a patient, you pay for the services that you receive while you're there, as opposed to a per-case payment structure which sets an average, and regardless of whether you stay 8 days or 15 days, you pay that average. The unit rate structure was set up specifically to be more equitable at the payer or patient level.
I'm Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Okay. Just a minute ago, you were talking about a certain rate for ICU. So whatever you're in ICU for, the rate's the same, or are there subsets within those specific categories? Because some ICU patients are going to be much more expensive than others. So
right, but the rate would be for the ICU would be established per day, and if they stay 8 days, then there will be a higher charge for that.
No matter what they're in there for. You're assuming the same level of care, so...
I think there are two parts to your question in answer to it. One is that the rate that they charge, the hospital has to charge on average. Hospitals themselves may set up a charge master that reflects differences. As long as they're in compliance with that rate on average, it's fine. So, for example, in the ICU, they may decide themselves to set up a differential rate in ICU. A higher severity of case in the ICU is going to charge more. A lower severity case in the ICU is going to be less. As long as, on average, by the end of the year, they are at the rate that was set by the commission, a hospital is free to go ahead and do that. What the commission does is set, however, that single rate per day.
Another example would be in the medical surgical area. A hospital could decide to charge a little more for a private room as opposed to a semi-private room. As long as they meet the medical surgical rate that we set for them on average during the course of the year, there are no compliance issues. And that illustrates an important point in our rate setting, which is to macro-regulate, set these broad goals, and then provide as much flexibility as possible for the hospitals to operate themselves. And that's, I think, a very good illustration of that. We could turn to the next slide. And I mentioned structure of payment is important, and I'll talk a little bit more about structure because there is a little nuance to this, the rate structure.
Before we leave that last slide, you can go back to it. Influence medical practice. So push and pull there. So this is designed to make sure the patient gets appropriate tests and not tests they don't need, doctors have a tendency to prescribe more and more tests just to cover themselves for court action and stuff like that. So how do you?
Yeah, that's the nuance that I'll get into in the next slide. Okay. I wanted to talk about the second structural feature, which is establishing that revenue base or that rate base for each hospital. That's something that we do through what we refer to as a full rate review. We had to perform full rate reviews on all the hospitals in the state when we started rate setting in 1974. We used as building blocks to do that analysis those detailed financial statements, the uniform reporting of financial information, expense information the hospitals have provided to us. They provided to us, and as I said, on a very detailed level, both for the direct expenses, the overhead areas, into the categories that we defined for them. That enabled us then to do comparisons where we broke hospitals down into peer groups based on their characteristics, whether they're a rural facility, a teaching facility, suburban hospital with a high-tech focus in terms of the services they provided, to get closer approximation and comparability. Then once we broke them down in peer groups, we provided each hospital with basically the average level of cost for that individual peer group, after adjusting for labor market differences, after adjusting for differences in uncompensated care, all those differences that we considered to be legitimate and appropriate to adjust for. That then gave us a reasonable cost by revenue center for each facility. We then would mark up from cost to rates by a number of things. Uncompensated care provision, the markup that John had referred to before, that would be built into rates. There's certain cost-justified discounts in the system that are built into the markup. But then once you've set the cost that's reasonable, you mark it up to rates, multiply it times their budgeted volumes, that's their rate base. And you've got the second portion of your rate structure set. And the third structural element was, you've got the rate base, how do you update it year to year? And that was done through something called the inflation adjustment system, where we would look at underlying factors that drive cost. They're national indices that Medicare use, that we use also, that look at labor costs nationally, that look at supply costs, pharmaceuticals, contractual services. And generally, we update their rates on the basis of those factor cost inflation components. But we also look at a number of other issues, volume changes year to year. We recognize that a proportion of hospital costs are variable. Some proportion are fixed. We will recognize that within the rate setting system in terms of how their costs and their revenues are changing. There are also rewards for efficiency or penalties for inefficiency that we would build into rate setting year to year as we update them. And various other adjustments. We do look at unusual costs and unusual circumstances that hospitals face. But what you find is, under this type of system, is hospitals then rarely come in for another full rate review. The vast majority of hospitals live under this update system, where they have had their rates set reasonably, they're under a constraint moving forward, and they have very strong incentives to focus on their costs, lower their costs, because that's how they generate a profit. That's the general structure. Now, moving to the next slide, you talked about how do you encourage medical practice to be efficient. We learned very, very early on that while it was a laudable goal to control that rate of growth and inflation of those unit prices year after year. The name of the game really was intensity per case, the amounts of goods and services that are provided, the length of stay on a per case basis. And while we could hold down the rate of growth, what we found out in the very early years is that we weren't really controlling the rate of growth of cost per case or charge per case, because the utilization would go up in response. So what the commission did is institute a system that they called the Guaranteed Inpatient Revenue System, or the Charge Per Case System is what it is called currently, where it's our analog to the Medicare per case payment system. It superimposes on top of that departmental unit rate structure where patients pay for the services they receive at the time of discharge. A per case mix adjusted, so we take into consideration differences in level of severity of illness of patients at a given hospital. A per case standard or target by DRG, by diagnostic related group, that the hospital has to meet at the end of the year. It doesn't result in a flat payment at the time of discharge, as a per case payment system would. But what it does is it sensitizes the hospital to this idea of controlling utilization, being efficient in medical practice. And really what it does is it aligns the incentive between the payer, who, if they can engage in utilization review, hold down length of stay, they realize a benefit at the time of discharge, with the incentive of the hospital, because they know at the end of the year, if they do a good job of controlling utilization along with the payer, they will get a reward in their rates generally. And it provides very, very strong incentives to control that per case increase year to year.
Madam Chair.
Before we go on, just to know, we have about 10 more minutes and we're going to need to be out of the room.
Okay.
But what we're going to do then is we'll recess till 5:30, and whatever you are not able to cover, we'll
sure.
start with you.
Well, I'll try to get through the rest of this quite quickly.
Well, if I could.
Yes, Ms. Senator Cruz.
Is there a conflict between, because you're trying to utilize services and not overutilize, and let's say a doctor says, I want a CT scan, then I want a PET scan, on, but the technician says, really, all you need is a CAT scan, you really don't need this other one. I mean, are you setting up a conflict there, or whatever the doctor prescribes is what the patient gets, or how does that work?
Well, I think, you know, there are multiple forces interacting on doctor decision-making and hospital decision-making. One is that the patient receive adequate care and
right.
quality of care. There's certainly things that impact that now, the medical malpractice. There are issues with regard to inspections, JCO inspections, and quality of care there. We're moving down the road of being able to monitor hospitals in terms of quality and outcomes and be much more effective along those lines. So I think you certainly still have that dynamic where the doctor and the hospital want the patient to receive the best care possible, but within limits, within a cognizance of doing it in the most efficient way possible. There's also certainly recognized in the literature, you don't want merely to provide as many services as possible to patients, because that's not high quality medicine either. Keeping patients in longer than they need to, exposed to infections and things of that nature. So it's a balancing act. And what we've tried to do is inject just a cognizance of the efficiency and an incentive to be more efficient in that medical decision making process.
Thank you.
So very strong incentives to be efficient. We've effectively controlled charge per case. That this is the primary reason why that you've seen the success on that chart, moving from 25% above the U.S. down to about 6%. We've done that gradually. Hospitals have been able to achieve productivity savings over time and outstrip the U.S. by about 1 to 3% per year on the basis of charge per case. You've aligned the incentives between the hospitals and the payers, so they're working together on trying to be more efficient. And I think it really shows one of the success factors of the system. Last structural element that we have in place is a mechanism to monitor hospitals over time and their charge per case, again, on a case mix adjusted basis, taking into consideration all these legitimate differences to see where they stack up relative to their peers. It's something we call the screens. We run it twice a year. We look at their adjusted charge per case relative to their brethren, and if hospitals get too high, we focus on them for rate negotiations. It points out another aspect of the system, which is that we focus on the poor performers. We don't have enough time, energy, and we don't want to go in and look at every hospital every year. We merely look at the outliers. And the screens are a mechanism for doing that, to make sure that things stay reasonable across the board for hospitals. So, to kind of summarize our regulatory approach, John's mentioned many of these things. There was a strong a mandate to have a local solution to local problems. We also do try to promote hospital social missions. We have predominantly community-based hospitals, nonprofit facilities. They have a strong commitment to their communities for access for those without insurance. The medical education is also a strong social mission for several of our hospitals. We try to support that and other means of supporting the community health status. We spend a lot of time focusing in on equity and fairness. I've tried to emphasize that in my presentation. Our approach is to minimize regulatory intervention, not micromanage facilities. There's a high degree of public accountability. All of our meetings are in public. The public can come and testify and address the commission at any point in time. It's a prospective system of incentives and targets that provides, I think, a high degree of predictability. And as John said before also, we try to encourage trust and cooperation. Some of this is covering some of these points from before, but the fundamental features are prospective, incentive-based, focus on data and information. And one point in that regard, whether you go to an all-payer system or just a partial-payer system, moving in the direction of getting information, having data that are transparent and that allows you to know more about costs and charges is a very, very substantial achievement, I would argue. Whether you go to full rate setting or move to an all-payer type of structure, to take that first step and actually collect data and information would be quite an achievement. And then it gives you the flexibility to approach these other problems in different ways. I talked about some of these other issues, focusing on poor performers, prohibiting cost shifting, which is a very dysfunctional aspect of our healthcare market, not focusing on controlling profits, rather focus on controlling charges and cost, and then basically adopting a longer-term perspective. I think maybe what I should do is, in the interest of time, maybe stop here, see if you have any additional questions. There are some other features of the system that would be worth talking about at some point, but I know we're running a little bit late, and I would think that you probably have some final questions.
Any? Senator George?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned back on page 14 the issue of quality and outcomes, and I kept looking for that because I'm thinking about cost control, and I'm thinking, sure, we could have a Yugo being uniformly made with a wooden seat. Yeah. And I really was pleased that you finally got around to quality and to outcomes. When you measure those, how does this system compare with surrounding states or nationwide?
Well, again, I would submit that if you have a system under rate regulation where you have the world's premier hospital operating, that's right. A system where quality is functioning. There has not been ever in the history of the Commission any legitimate suggestion that quality of care was compromised because of the rate setting. That's not been the case.
There have been some studies that show that there's not a statistical difference between rate setting states and non-rate setting states in the question of quality. I've seen data from CMS recently that places Maryland in the middle to the upper tier of states nationally. I mean, there's certainly some things that we can improve on, I think, as all states can in the quality area, and that's one of the things that we are focusing in on is a pay for performance initiative to reward hospitals on the basis of process indicators, not outcomes at this stage, but process indicators that are highly correlated with quality outcomes.
follow up on that. You probably have a regulatory structure to make sure that those hospitals are, in fact, operating in a safe and respectful manner. If you see somebody who's in trouble, do you invite them to come back in and consider rate adjustments in order to get that quality issue back under control?
That's a tough issue. What we've found in the past is that hospitals will sort of argue both sides. They'll argue that, you know, if they're high-quality facilities, they should be rewarded, be paid more money because they're high-quality facilities. On the other hand, we'll have hospitals that would maybe not have as good outcome measures, and they'll argue they also are entitled to additional money so they can increase and
improve.
They're all instances they want more money. We're trying to devise something that will recognize both high levels of performance and provide rewards for that, as well as incentive payments for hospitals that do show improvement over time. It's a bit of a balancing act. Mm-hmm. Can't always be more, more, more. It has to be a payback to the public.
Right.
But the idea is to get everyone up to a reasonable standard in terms of outcomes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. When CMS or whatever iteration they were in at the time closed the loop on the Maryland waiver, why did they do that? Do you have a sense of that? Why? I mean, you guys got a waiver that nobody else can get because the door's been closed on that. So why did they close the door on that?
I think it was largely because the recognition that the rate-setting system has been in operation for as long as it has been, that it would be unfair for a system that began in 1977, well before prospective payment system came into place, to impose a standard that applied from 1983 going forward. That we had saved the federal system money, the Maryland system had saved the federal system money from 1977 going forward, and there needed to be a mechanism to account for that fact, and that's why they went for a rate of increase test. And it was closed around the time that PPS went into effect, so nobody else was precluded from it, and it measures it from a point in time that is now in the distant past. And I think that's in simple terms is why it was changed.
Okay, Madam Chair, I guess it's just a curiosity that if it is saving the Fed's money, why they would shut the door, but then the Feds do some
strange things. They left the door open for other rate systems to go forward. They didn't close the door entirely. There's still 1886C, where others can come in and do something differently. Just the measure by which you measure that performance is different.
And why did the other states stop their rate setting?
I think it's probably fair to say that in at least two of them, when TPS went into effect, the hospitals in those states thought that they would make more money under the federal system than if they did under the state, kept setting rates. As it turned out, they were wrong.
New York State was an example of that. They have, you know, as you know, many, many teaching hospitals, and the reimbursement mechanism when PPS started was very, very generous for teaching under PPS. And I made the calculation,
right.
Thought they'd do better, and the Feds clamped down on IME.
I think that's part of it, and I think the other part of it is, frankly, that in those other states, the relationship that had developed over the years between the regulators, the regulatees, and the payers is very different and much more hostile than it is in Maryland. We've been able to have a system where we disagree with one another, but we're not disagreeable. We're able to work out problems, and there have been serious problems over the years in keeping the waiver. But we've all been able to come to the table. I don't think that was generally the case in other jurisdictions. So there's a lot more distrust of the regulators, a lot more distrust of the hospitals, and the payers were not as actively involved. And I think that was part of it. So we were able to, in Maryland over the years, develop this system that has enjoyed strong support, and strong enough support that we've been able to weather the storms that naturally come up over time.
Senator George, and then we're going to need to recess.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Do you believe, I mean, I've really been impressed with what we've heard today about what's happening in Maryland, and one of the things that's impressed me is I think the approach of the regulators here is extremely fair. Do you think this can be duplicated again?
I would hope that what you do in Oregon works for Oregon.
Right.
And I wouldn't copy wholesale what we did. I think part of what the lesson that I think we can tell you is we designed a system in Maryland that was going to work for the culture, the politics, and the structure of the hospitals in Maryland, and to do so in a way that benefited everybody. I would hope that if any state were to do it, they would do it in a way that works best for them. Could it be done in other states? Absolutely. Are there things that can be done to improve a hospital system in other states? Absolutely. Are there things that the federal government could benefit from by having more experimentation? Absolutely. Whether it is in the area of quality of care, information technology, any number of areas that can do improvement. I think you can structure it to have it be successful. But I wouldn't expect you to do it Oldendale copying what Maryland has done.
We're going to need to recess, but Mr. Colmers and Mr. Murray are going to be back with us this evening. We will have a public hearing on 502, and we'll be having a panel discussion with Ken Rutledge from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, as well as with Mr. Colmer and Mr. Murray. So with that, we are recessed till 5:30.
Thank you.
Thank you.